Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We live in a world of tea drinkers. Coffee-drinking Americans have come late to the party. But it's quite a party, a regular Zen festival at its high end. Legend has it that a living Buddha cut off his eyelids for greater awareness, threw them on the ground, and the first tea sprang up. A new documentary follows one man and his love affair with top-quality tea as he travels through China, meeting with farmers and cutting through red tape to bring back the perfect cup. This hour on Point, we're sorting through the tea in China and beyond. Joining me now from San Francisco is David Lee Hoffman. He's a tea importer and founder of Silk Road Teas, which he sold in 2005. And he's the subject of a new documentary, All in This Tea, produced and directed by Les Blank and Gina Lebrecht. It follows his travels in China searching for the highest quality tea. The documentary is out on DVD at www.allinthistea.com. David Lee Hoffman, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
Also joining us from San Francisco is James Norwood Pratt, one of the world's leading experts on tea and tea history. His book, The Tea Lover's Treasury, has been called a Bible for tea drinkers. He's a legend himself in the tea drinking world and shows up prominently in All in This Tea. James Norwood Pratt, thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
So there's kind of a saga in this story. At this point, it's a little bit of history as well. New York Times watched the documentary and said it's got keen insights and drunken raptures. Let me play a little bit of tape here from another tea aficionado who makes several appearances. This is Gaetano Kazuo Maeda, a tea expert, describing the many flavors to be found in one cup of tea.
Hey, this is a Drum Mountain Clouds and Mist green tea from China. Buttery, vegetal, rich, fragrant, not flowery, slightly, we'll say, oceanic, maybe seaweed touch.
Who wouldn't want an oceanic cup of tea? David Lee Hoffman, we'll go to your adventures in tea land. But tell us where you are now. You sold the business that you built over many years of bringing back the finest teas you could find from China. Are you still in the tea world, sir?
Well, I'm still in the tea world. I kept the pu'er part of the business. These are the aged teas from Yunnan province.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working as a consultant, and I still do tea tastings and talks on tea.
And James Norwood Pratt, you make several wonderful, colorful appearances in the documentary. But what about the direction American tea drinking is taking? I'm looking at some numbers here that say, between, 1990 and last year, overall sales of tea, wholesale sales, have gone from $1.8 billion to almost $7 billion in this country. That would appear to suggest a United States in a huge tea upswing. Is that how you see it?
Tea has finally arrived to save us.
To save us from what, sir?
Well, you might consider it a coffee recovery movement, Tom.
You're going to break us off the Java?
I don't think you have to swear allegiance to one or the other, but we're finally catching up with the rest of the world where tea is mankind's favorite beverage. Has been for not centuries, but millennia. And there are good reasons for that Americans are also discovering these days.
Does it matter, David Lee Hoffman, tremendously to you that an awful lot of these billions being sold in tea in this country now, we'll go to the top quality stuff, but an awful lot of it is in the ready-to-drink market, which I guess is all kinds of, tea and plastic and glass bottles and vending machines and ready to go. Surely that's not the sublime cup of tea that you spent a lot of your life searching for.
Well, it's always fun to go off in the search for the ultimate tea, but in reality, I drink very common teas most of the time. Excuse me. It's about enjoying the beverage rather than, having to have the ultimate tea at every time you make a pot of tea. It's really about, I think, slowing down, enjoying tea with friends and and really just taking time out of the busy day to have a cup.
In this documentary, we have scene after scene of you burying your face in great bags and bales of tea, looking for the great one or the great ones to buy and take home. It's not easy back in the 90s when you were doing this, and we'll talk about what might have changed there. But give us a sense, if you'd be good enough, David Lee Hoffman, of kind of the pyramid of tea. What's down at the bottom in the humdrum, you know, drink it and forget it portion? And then what do you move up to as you move up the scale toward what you were searching for in China?
Well, at the bottom of the pyramid, we see it in all the food shops and supermarkets. It's a common tea bags. It doesn't offer any surprises. It's very predictable. And it may not be a bad taste, but it certainly doesn't go very far. And it's very easy to get bored with something like that. Although I must say that a lot of people enjoy that type of beverage, and that's fine for them. I have one customer who tends to buy my finest teas, but his wife will drink nothing but decaf Liptons.
Okay.
So, you know, there you go.
And as you move on up, James, what have you seen yourself and David Lee Hoffman and others looking for over the years to get into the middle and top of that pyramid of tea?
Well, I came to tea, Tom, from California wine, and it was the perfect training, the perfect background to appreciate tea. Wine and tea are both of them agricultural products which at best aspire to being a work of art.
Mm.
And actually there's only about 10, maybe 5% of all the wine or all the tea in the world that achieves that status of being a work of art. The rest of it can be good enough as long as it's wet and goes down the right way.
and much of it does. There's a great scene over a business lunch in China, David, where you're trying to make your case after gone by, you know, bottoms up after bottoms up of wine. But you want to talk with your Chinese hosts about tea and good tea, and you're complaining right in their faces that they're not collecting it the right way. They're not bringing it. They're not making it available anymore. That their focus on industrial production of tea is hurting the quality of the country's tea. Let's listen to just a little bit from All in This Tea. Here you are at the lunch table, deep in your cups, lecturing your Chinese hosts.
My interest is mainly tea, and the best tea in the world is still found in China, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to find that good tea. When I talk to the old people, they say the tea was better 40 years ago than today. The only emphasis on high production.
There you are. It's 1997, the film took a long time to come out. But how did that go down with your hosts in 97, and has it changed today, David?
Well, I got a little bit spoiled, I think, in the early days, because I was finding really good teas, great teas, from the farmers out in the countryside. So I knew they existed.
And what do you mean by early days here?
Well, I started going to China in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And as I made these discoveries of wonderful teas in very small quantities, and it was very difficult to get teas out of the country in those days. The export company pretty much had a monopoly on exporting the tea from China.
Mm.
And when I go to them to export these small quantities of teas, they say, well, we can't do this, but we have our own teas, and we could gladly supply you with any quantity you want. But my problem was I didn't like those teas. They often looked very nice, but as far as taste and aroma goes, left much to be desired.
And today, have those teas broken free from the system that you lament in the film? Do we get the top quality tea from China now? So much has changed in the last 10 years in China generally.
We're certainly getting much better quality than we did 10 years ago. The tea market has changed considerably, partly due because of the wealth and affluence of the economy in China, and people can now afford to buy the best teas themselves. And they are. Their money is no object. They'll put down huge amounts of money and on the promise that they're being given the best teas. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they just pay a lot of money for more common teas.
James, can we walk into a tea shop in the United States, or for that matter, a supermarket aisle, and find something that would approach the superlative as you describe it?
You can approach it in those places. And let me add, that's thanks largely to David's pioneering. There was no China tea to be had easily in this country before David Lee Hoffman and Roy Fong first made fine China tea available.
The great scenes in the documentary where David is out in these beautiful terraced mountains and up in the misty tea plantations on foot, kind of humping it across China looking for this stuff bag by bag. It's a labor of love.
Well, the finest tea can never be mass-produced, so it's always in a small batch from a particular harvest that you're looking for, and David was the first to bring them back for us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about tea, all the tea in China, good, bad, and ugly, how Americans find it, get it, drink it, that world of tea, with top American tea aficionados David Lee Hoffman, subject of a new documentary, All in This Tea, and James Norwood Pratt, one of the world's top writers and thinkers on tea. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Roy Fong as well from San Francisco. So let's listen as we go in here to a little bit of the sound from an oolong tea competition, a winner being announced in Anxi District of China. A scene from the documentary All in This Tea, produced and directed by Les Blank and by Gina Lebrecht, of course. And if you could picture this, there's beautiful Chinese maidens, each with their tray of tea, and winners being announced and red sashes being put over shoulders as the gathered audience there sips their tea. David Lee Hoffman and James Norwood Pratt join us from San Francisco. And also from San Francisco right now, Roy Fong is with us, founder and proprietor of the Imperial Tea Court there, one of the first traditional Chinese tea houses in America. He's also a founding member of the International Tea Masters Association. Roy Fong, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're very well. First of all, what's your sense of how Americans' taste in tea is evolving? Is it evolving, Roy?
Well, in my experience, you know, I started the Imperial Tea Court in 1993. At that time, you'd be hard-pressed to understand what black tea and poor teas were. Most people would just want to know whether they're whole leaf tea or tea bag.
Mm-hmm.
From today, people will buy tea that's worth hundreds of dollars a pound, and people typically, the idea of not using boiling water on green tea was so foreign before that. When I first started telling people, you don't necessarily always have to have boiling water to bring out the flavor. People look at me like I'm from Mars.
Right.
But now, almost as a matter of course, people sort of understand, at least, you know, people who are into higher quality tea, that you don't necessarily always use boiling water.
And you must know the story of David Lee Hoffman sort of battling with bureaucracy in China to get out into the hinterlands and try and get out these individual, very fine teas. What have you thought? What did you think of that quest over the years as he would strike out for China trying to bring it back? Did he look like Don Quixote out there to you, Roy Fong, or like the pioneers, James Norwood Pratt says, bringing it home for Americans?
Let me tell you, I know David since 1993, and I've always said from that day until today that no matter what happened or whether you agree with David or not, the man deserves a lot of credit because I speak perfect Chinese and I'm Chinese, and I have those same difficulties that he does. And for him, sort of a foreigner would doubt the use of the language. To be able to do that, you have to have such a drive that there's a few of us who just really can help themselves. You know, it's not just a commitment. It's just that it's something that that's in you, that you, some kind of inner strength that you don't even know exists to just drive you. So, you know, I appreciate and always respect him for that.
There's a marvelous scene in the documentary. I want to listen to it with all of you and get your responses here. David, you are the intrepid hero of the film. It's travelogue, biography, Nature Ode, the New York Times says. They also call it Nerd Profile in part. It's a kind of nerdiness we treasure here to sort of, I guess, just an obsessed quality to get out there with your own goals in mind. And there's a scene where you're in Fujian, I think, with businessman Song Di Feng. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but you're in Fujian province. You're standing in the street with this Chinese kind of, tea bureaucrat, and you are really arguing about how you want to buy the local teas, you want to get the individuals. He's not going for us. We're going to listen. But set this up for us, David. What's the scene here?
The scene was, I want to be able to find the tea and buy the tea and bring it back here, the exact same lot that I select. And they always try to tell me, oh, well, you pick the tea and then we'll have our factory make it for you.
Yeah, no problem.
It's not going to be the same tea any more than you could do that with wine or any other food product. It takes certain skills, and there's so many variables that go into producing a fine tea that you simply can't replicate it because you have a modern factory.
So here are the farmers with their teas. You want to buy it. They're not going to let you. We've got a minute or so of tape here, David and James and Roy. Let's just listen. As the truly committed tea lover, tea trader, works his heart out on a back road in China to try and bring it home to the United States. This is David Lee Hoffman in All in This Tea. Let's take a listen.
Just ask this man to collect the teas and to get samples. And we will check the quality. If the quality is the same as the sample, okay, done. This way.
I don't want to do it that way. I want to select the teas, take that tea, and physically put it in one place and say, that's the tea that I want. Not something else that's similar to that.
So that's what we can't do that.
Why? This is the way we talked about in Hangzhou. I want to select the tea. I want to see the tea. And choose and decide that's the tea we want. Then we put it on the scale, we weigh it, we figure out how much it is, and go to the next place. And then everyone gets paid for that tea. We're in a very different part of China. The teas are different, the strains are different, the climate's different, the soil's different, the farmers are different. You can't make the same tea.
So this is the main reason our company didn't do business directly with the farmers, because every year the teas come out are different. So if I follow the way you do, I'm afraid our company don't allow me to do this thing.
David Lee Hoffman and his business counterpart in China, they're standing in the street, rooster crowing, tractor putting, wind blowing. It's it all in this tea. Roy Fong, what do you make of that? Talk about pugnacious. This tea trader, David Lee Hoffman, doesn't give up.
Yes, I think, you know, you typically have to do that kind of thing because, obviously the company have their own goal, of which is to, you know, keep their share of your money. So, you know, when you feel you're right, you just have to stand your ground. And I think a few of us have all went through that kind of scenario. You know, it's fortunate that someone actually captured this for the camera for other people to see.
It really is. James Norwood Pratt, you're back on the sipping end of that, but there's your man out in the field bringing home the tea.
Well, I'm sitting here with my two teachers of China tea, I want you to know.
Good. When you put your teacup to your lips or your nose into the tea, as such a respected tea aficionado, how do you begin to know whether you're drinking from the bottom or the top of the pyramid? If you've got a tip-top tea of some kind, and I know there's a wide range, what tells you that for our listening audience who may never have had that experience, James?
Well, experience tells you, Tom, experience. After years of drinking tea, and it suffices if you're a beginner to just pay attention for a few weeks, you will notice the jewel-like color, the appearance of the leaf, both the dry leaf and the infused leaf, the aroma, all of this before you ever lift that cup to your lips and take your first sip. So learning about tea comes from observation, and the more teas you have experienced, the more you have to compare the present tea to, you see.
And take one in particular. I know they're so different, but oolong. We heard the tasting competition at the top of this segment. In a great oolong tea, first, how do you distinguish oolong from others, and what makes a great oolong, let's say?
Well, oolong is one of the six families of tea, the white, yellow, green. Then there's black and pu'er and oolong, which mm-hmm. is in between green and black. Mm-hmm. It is green tea is unoxidized, black tea is fully oxidized, and oolong tea is oxidized a little but not completely, not mm-hmm. like black. Mm-hmm. And this gives it a unique character, which is that way of processing produces a tea that is flamboyantly aromatic. You get more aroma from oolong than any other type of tea. So that's the first thing you're looking for. Mm.
I might add it's also the most labor-intensive tea to produce and demanding the most skill out of, I think, all the teas. Roy, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think, you know, oolong tea is definitely the one tea that people learn to like very easily, because it's such a big category. As James was saying, the fermenting or oxidization can be a little bit, or can be a little bit more, could be quite a bit, and how you roast it, when even to what time of the day it was picked makes a difference.
David, I wish you'd walk us through a little bit of that preparation. Much is made of it in the documentary. You know, the processing in the big tumblers, the way it's picked. You say so much depends on the individual farmer, how they handle the tea leaves, even at the moment they're being picked and before, and then through the processing. Take us through some of, viscerally, what it takes to make a great oolong.
Well, typically, it's a long family tradition. They've never learned to make teas using scales and clocks and timers, and it's all done by the senses, by tradition. So the family knows when to pick by following the progress of the tea plants, and the window of opportunity might just be a couple of days, and then it's time they'll pick the tea. And they'll go through the withering process and the rolling and the firing. Everything takes precise timing. And the farmers know when the tea is right. They didn't learn this from reading books and going to college. They learned it from their parents, from their family friends who are involved in the business of making tea. And in the case of oolongs, it's so labor-intensive when you compare it with, say, white teas, which are simply just dried, or green teas, which are rolled and fired. But
you
with
got
oolongs,
baking and firing in the documentary, even a scene where they're wrapping it very tightly in cheesecloth and kind of compressing it with their knee against a bench. I mean, it's really manipulating and massaging this thing.
Yeah. That's oolong making.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And that's often repeated, I don't know, 8-10 times for a top-rate tea, top-rate oolong.
The wrapping and pressing and compressing again and again.
That's called rolling.
Oh, that's fantastic. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let me begin to turn to them. Andrea is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrea, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Years ago, I stayed on a tea plantation in Sri Lanka. And I had tea there that was like ambrosia. The scent was like an autumn day in New Hampshire. I've never come across tea like that since, and I wondered if you could tell me, first, what kind of tea do I have, and where can I find it? Thanks.
We'll do it. James, can you take us on a little geography lesson here, geography of tea?
Yes, Miss Andrea, you were drinking a black tea, almost certainly, because over 90% of what Ceylon produces, Sri Lanka produces, is called Ceylon black tea. And it can, at best, be heavenly stuff. Sounds like you got it at its best.
But, of course, the road mainly goes back to China. In the documentary, David, there's the story of Robert Fortune with the British East India Company, who went incognito, more undercover than you, a century and more ago, to break China's tea monopoly, bring it out into Darjeeling, and get tea planted elsewhere.
Well, as the historian on the program,
yes, please,
Tom,
sir.
let me tell you that all the tea in China was the source of all the tea in the world, except for that in Japan, right up until the British broke that monopoly. And of course, the British decided that tea should be, number one, made on a colonial model in their own possessions in India. That meant plantations. And number two, that it should be industrialized, its production. So you see, it was too complicated to make all the types of tea. Mm. You couldn't have a customer base that some wanted green and some oolong and others wanted white tea. The British decided it would all be black. That's why today most of us drink black tea in this country and think that's the only kind of tea we can get.
And if you taste a Sri Lankan Roy Fong versus a Darjeeling or something, I don't know, you tell us. Can you tell the difference? Can you tell if it's from Sri Lanka?
Yeah, I think the difference is pretty distinct. I want to also add a little bit to Andrea's question. Drinking it white and at the farm, because the tea has just been finished and dried, and that fragrant and aromatic is at its top optimal. No matter how fast you ship it from that point into the country, even if you DHL, it's going to take a few days. Most likely, the shipment comes in by ocean, and it's a month or two before it gets to the vendors who sells it in this country. So I hate to break it to Andrea, but it's not probably going to be very, very difficult to find that experience at a vendor's countertop here.
She's may have to go back to Sri Lanka to do it. It sounds like she wouldn't mind doing that. David, are you still out in the wilds of China tasting, and do you miss it if you're not?
Yes, I do. I go there every year, and it's part of my routine now. And, I enjoy the challenge of finding tea, and I certainly enjoy all the friends I've made through the process of starting a business and being successful in the business. Although in a way I failed, I think I tried to downsize the business, keep it more manageable, but it kept on growing, which I guess shows to the popularity of tea these days.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about tea and the best tea in China, how one American set out to find it, the world of tea now, and how Americans get it and drink it. We're joined by top American tea aficionados. David Lee Hoffman is with us, subject of a new documentary, All in This Tea. Great tea connoisseur and historian James Norwood Pratt is with us as well. And Roy Fong, who's founder and proprietor of San Francisco's Imperial Tea Court, all with us today. Here's a little bit from the documentary, All in This Tea, of David in Hong Kong sampling wares in a small tea shop right there in Hong Kong streets.
Let's taste this and this. And this. Three.
The tea tasting going on, and it's quite a journey to get to the best stuff. And to try and get it out, and also along the way, a lot of talk about how the cultivation of tea, the proper raising and processing of it, means a kind of harmony with the earth itself. Sarita's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Sarita, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I totally agree with what was said earlier about tea, good tea being more easily available in America now. You know, I've lived here in this country for about 20 years, and I have to say in the last 5 years it's become much easier to find a good cup of tea.
Very good.
But I think what seems to be still missing is this atmosphere or the ritual that's associated with drinking tea. And I've certainly seen that when I grew up in India, and I've recreated some of that ritual here with my children, where one of the most favorite things for us to do is to sit around with a hot cup of tea, and of course their tea is sugared down and with lots of milk, but that is a conversation point, and that's something that the family huddles around, and I've seen that in tea shops in Europe. Just doesn't seem to have that sense replicated here in the U.S., and I wonder what it's going to take for us to have that kind of association in America with the rituals associated with tea.
Wonderful question. Roy Fong, you live right in the midst of that. I spent about 10 years in Asia, from Japanese tea ceremony right on down through China and India, Sri Lanka, and I know exactly what Sarita's talking about. When Americans come into the tea-drinking realm, your realm, Roy, do they want to bring that sort of ritual approach with them, or is it the grab-and-go sensibility of a fast-paced society?
Well, I think what it takes is time. You know, you have to want to understand that America come a little bit late on this party. But, you know, the wonderful thing about tea is that there's a level of tea for anyone and everyone, as long as you want to. If you want to grab-and-go, there's certainly levels of tea for you. And if you want to be with ritualistic and artistic on your presentation, there's tea for you. And in my customers, I can tell you, I'm a very small business, and I don't advertise. We have over 10,000 people on our waiting list. And people come in. You know, I'm not even surprised when people come in.
On your waiting, 10,000 people waiting to come in, sit in your tea court and drink tea?
No, I mean, this is the people who came and purchased tea, signed up for a mailing list.
Oh, yes, I see. Mm-hmm.
Right. But, you know, I'm not even surprised when a blonde and blue-eyed guy come in and speak Chinese to me anymore. You know, so it just goes to show you that, yes, it's not as big a part of people's life as in other country, but in my small experience, that has changed so much. But, you know, in the overall picture of the scheme of the thing for Americans, tea is a very small part of their life. But given time, I don't think it'll ever take over coffee or wine or whatever. But I think eventually tea will be a rather important part of Americans' lives. And that those who want the rituals and those who want the tradition will be able to find them easy enough. Just like 5 years ago, you weren't able to even find decent tea easily. Now you can find a pretty good quality tea rather easily. And so it's only a matter of 5 years. So maybe in another five, the ritual will be much more prominent in people's lives.
James, how about it? You hear Sarita happy for the greater access to fine tea, but not seeing Americans so much adopting rituals around tea. Maybe that's a shoe that just doesn't fit to the mass scale in this country,
or
might it?
Oh, no. It's on its way, Tom. Be assured. You see, tea requires ritual, and each tea requires a different ritual. Tea takes time to steep. Tea requires that things be done in a certain order. Until the water has been heated, you can't pour it over the leaf. So this is the ritual, and the ritual for preparing green tea is different from the ritual for oolong or black, and that ritual is part of the enjoyment of tea. It is not just an add-on, it is essential. The making of tea properly, so that you get the most out of that tea leaf that farmer worked so hard to make perfect for you, it's the making of that tea that's part of the pleasure. And the ritual is what we call the making of the tea.
David, is it a life changer? I mean, in a way, there seems to me to be a thread that goes all the way from the kind of cultivation you were looking for, organic ideally, not industrial, in tune with the rhythms of the regions of China you're in, a thread that goes all the way out to how it's consumed. The documentary seems to suggest that if we got our tea right, we'd have the planet right. Is that too, you know, airy-fairy?
Well, I feel it's nice to have a choice. I mean, there's so many teas out there in the world, and finally we're able to walk into different tea shops and have a choice. If we're looking for a particular taste or an experience, we could find it now. And, you know, I've met so many wonderful people through tea, and for me, that's what it's about. It's, you know, there was some calligraphy over one of the great tea masters in China over his altar, and it said, through tea, making friends. And for me, that's a big part of what tea is about. You know, it's friendship and drinking and enjoying. And this has to do with, you know, a ritual in a way. It's, we create our own rituals. We learn from other styles and other cultures, and we incorporate those. America is based on, you know, the melting pot of different cultures and styles. And we are creating what will be known as American tea. And perhaps it doesn't exist now. We could talk about Chinese tea and Japanese tea and English tea. But
what do you mean by American tea?
Well, let me interrupt, mm-hmm. David, because you've just inspired me again in saying tea is about making friends. The point of ritual...
Sounds like kumbaya tea.
Well, in a way, one of the results of the ritual of preparing your tea for yourself or for others is making friends with yourself. Don't forget, we live in a society that demands more and more and delivers less and less to us. And this tea is a moment of windless calm and the bluster of daily events. It is a chance to make friends not just with the person across the table, but with the person inside of yourself.
Sounds good to me. Let's go to Ryan in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Ryan, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My friend went to Africa, I believe he went to South Africa, and he brought some tea back with him, and you had to drink it out of a little gourd. And through a straw, it looked like a silver straw, and it had like a little filter in it. And I was wondering, where could I find that tea? I don't know what it was called, but when you drink it, it seems like it would relax you, at the same time give you energy. It was shredded, and you had to fill this little gourd up. I mean, it fits in the palm of your hand.
And you're sure it was tea and not something else chewed in Africa?
Yeah, I mean, it was shredded up, put in this gourd, and you put water in it every now and then.
Yeah.
And you'd sip the water out, and you never heated it or, like, I guess, roasted it.
David, what do you make of the story from Africa there? Is it a tea story?
It doesn't sound like it's Camellia sinensis tea. It's probably one of the barks or herbs that has been infused in a gourd.
I think that's yerba mate from Argentina.
Well, I was going to say that. It sounds, but I was trying to think what they would have in South Africa. And I don't think that was actual tea.
When we speak of tea, yes. We mean from the tea plant.
Mm-hmm.
And while we can make a beverage from all kinds of roots and berries and leaves and barks, unless it comes from the tea plant, Camellia sinensis, we really shouldn't call it tea.
David, at one point in the film, you're describing tea trees, I guess is the right word, that are hundreds of years old, 500, 600, 700 years old, and still being plucked for tea production, for shoots to begin production elsewhere. Really? Hundreds of years old?
Yes, even thousands of years old. But the ones that are hundreds of years old is probably the Phoenix teas from Phoenix Mountain. And the remarkable thing about those trees, and they're literally trees, is that they have been picked continuously for hundreds of years. And the taste is quite remarkable. One of the qualities of that tea is that the roots go down, 25, 30 feet. So it taps into nutrients that you wouldn't get from the shallow planting from commercial fields. So naturally, the taste is going to be quite different.
Wow, the taste
another
of hundreds of years.
For you,
yes, James, yes.
I say that Phoenix is another oolong for you.
Yes, right there, and it's my favorite. But David, in Amherst, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm going to be traveling on Monday to Yunnan Province, And I understand about 100 miles southwest is a town called Puer that makes a very famous tea. And I'm wondering what your guests would say about that tea and whether it's worth visiting that region. And if I emailed, could they tell me some special places to go around that region?
Where to go in Yunnan for great tea? Now, you're citing Puer, which, as David points out, is a kind of tea. Fermented tea. David, what do you say to David there?
David, you're going to have a great time in Yunnan, especially if you like Puer teas. And you'll probably be getting off the plane in Kunming. There's at least three major tea markets there, and you won't have any problem discovering lots and lots of teas to taste.
A particular direction or destination that you would outline for him, or just trust that it will be there?
Well, the town of Puer isn't that interesting. It's certainly true the tea got its name from that town. It used to be an historical market town and trade center for this style of tea. But I think if you start your journey in Kunming and then work your way down through Samao and Sichuanbana into Jinhong, you'll find lots and lots of different teas to choose from. And all the restrictions that I found 10, 15 years ago have now been lifted. So you're pretty much free to travel to all the ancient mountains in the south there.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, our Yunnan traveler, and thanks for calling. Let's go to North Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you very much for this program and all of your programs. You have a terrific show.
Oh, thank you.
And your guest is wonderful. I happen to be a lover of Thai tea. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be going out shortly to have a Thai lunch. I look forward to Thai iced tea. It has an orange, kind of a dark amber color and a wonderful fragrance. I don't have to add any sugar or anything else to it. When I have it as an iced tea, I add a little milk. But I can't seem to find it commercially. What is it called generically?
Well, Roy, James, David, what about Thai tea? You know, I know it well. It's that kind of rather sweet, milky. I think in Thailand I've had it very hot with a raw egg dumped in it for breakfast. What is that? And can you buy it outside the Thai restaurants?
I wish you could tell me. I've been looking for years to find out what makes Thai tea the way it is. I love it too, but I have no explanation.
Roy Fong, have you got an insight for us?
You know, I think it's more than just tea. There's some herbs involved. I'm not quite clear what exactly it is. But one news about Thailand is that now it's also making pretty good oolong teas. People from Taiwan actually is planting in Thailand, and they've been at it for about 10 years now. And it's now starting to produce pretty decent tea from oolong tea, very much like the Taiwan variety of green kind of looking oolong. So I can't help him too much with the Thai tea, iced tea, unfortunately, but he may be surprised one day in a Thai restaurant that he gets a great cup of oolong tea.
Yeah, well, good luck in that search outside the restaurant, but if you have to go to the restaurant for it, that's not the worst punishment on earth. David, what about the flow of teas from China today? Is that you reference it here, but has the problem that you were up against diminished? Are Chinese entrepreneurs themselves going after that finest buds and single leaves and bring out the best, making it available, or is it still jammed up?
Well, the demand has increased domestically, as I pointed mm-hmm. out earlier. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just add, my wife is from Thailand, and I don't know what they put in that style of tea either. But as Roy pointed out, they're making some very good oolongs there. And my own quest has been for wild teas, which are still available in the mountain areas of northern Thailand. So one of the great finds I find about Thai tea are the ancient wild teas still growing there and being picked by the Akha people.
And what about this description of tea we heard right at the top of buttery, vegetal, and oceanic? James Norwood Pratt, what on earth is an oceanic touch in tea?
I think our friend Tano is talking about the seaweed flavor that you get in certain Japanese green teas particularly, but others too. You can have as large a tasting vocabulary as you please, but finally, taste belongs in a realm that no word can enter, Tom. Mm-hmm. You tend to look at your companion after you swallow, and a knowing smile spreads over both faces. You've just had a taste of that remarkable tea. You would know what oceanic meant.
Well, we've got the steam of it in our nose right now, and you make us want to run out and brew it and take our time in drinking it. What a wonderful tale and a wonderful journey. David Lee Hoffman, right at the center of it in the documentary All in This Tea, thank you for your intrepid efforts over the years, and thanks for letting us through the film go along with you a bit into the misty mountains of China there. Thanks for being with us today, David.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Roy Fong at San Francisco's Imperial Tea Court. Wonderful to have you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Tom.
James Norwood Pratt, you're a wonder. Thank you for being with us today.
Good on you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.